Summer officially starts June 20th. And what does that mean? Well, it means a lot of things to 77 million students in the U.S., but among them is certainly road trips. An integral part of any road trip is entertainment along the way. The National Museum of American History tells the stories behind American traditions, including perhaps the most common car ride entertainment, music. In this road trip edition of History Explorer podcast, we're taking a look at freedom songs and jazz.
Come on.
To freedom land.
Come on.
We're marching on.
Can the use of song provide inspiration for a movement? How about the strength to oppose violent injustice? In this month's episode of the History Explorer podcast series, we'll learn about the use of freedom songs during the Civil Rights Movement. Songs such as We Shall Overcome and This Little Light of Mine are well known. But did you know that even songs from 1960s pop music were incorporated into protest versions? We'll be speaking with Chris Wilson, the director of the program in African American culture here at the museum, who will talk about the use of music and song during the Civil Rights era, and how the songs are used in programs here on the museum's floor.
Okay, I'm Chris Wilson. I'm the director of the program in African American culture here at the museum, and also our daily programs department, which includes our theater programs.
Great. Now today we're going to be talking about freedom songs and how they were incorporated within the Civil Rights Movement and or how they are used here at the museum for public programs. First off, could you talk a little bit about what freedom songs are?
Well, freedom songs were really, in some ways, the lifeblood or the soul force of the Civil Rights Movement. They were involved in every part of the struggle, even the early days during the Montgomery bus boycott, and especially once students became involved in the 1960s, they attained an even more higher level of importance. Freedom songs generally came from the black church traditions and involved a call and response style of singing. But once we got into the 1960s, the songs came from lots of different genres and areas of American and African American culture, and you started seeing popular songs even turned into freedom songs. What the songs really did was to give the protesters courage. Bernice Johnson Reagan, my predecessor here at the museum, who founded the program in African American culture, but started as a protester in Albany during the Albany movement in 1962 in Georgia, and she was one of the original Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee freedom singers, and since has become an academic and has studied studied freedom songs. And as she says, she recounts at one point in a church in Albany, the sheriff and his deputies coming into the church and, you know, fear filling the room. Because, as you know, everyone knew the sheriff, and he knew their faces and their names, and they all knew he was there. Well, they started singing a song in this church, and as she said, the song let the sheriff know they were there, and the song gave people the power and the strength to stay in that room. It was the only thing that they could hold on to, because they knew, you know, that the power that in this case, the sheriff had. And the song really filled up the room, she said, and pushed the fear out, and the song being the only thing that eventually remained in the room. So it gave people strength in that way, but it also gave people internal strength, but it also projected strength.
Now, you mentioned that some of these songs had roots in African American culture, and then some of them through popular culture. What were some of the songs?
Well, yes, the songs had roots in African American culture, and singing in protest and in solidarity had roots in wider American culture as well. Just quickly moving back, you can look at the Civil War period with both blacks and white soldiers, but you know, I can think of some examples of African American soldiers marching off to war and hoping that they would be allowed to get into combat and really free themselves. And there's a song there's a song called "We Look Like Men of War." There's a song where Sojourner Truth took the Battle Hymn of the Republic and changed the lyrics of that song to reflect colored Yankee soldiers going off to war, so that has a long history. The use of spirituals and call and response in slavery was certainly, you know, has a long history for African Americans. And in the civil rights movement, those songs were again used in some of them, in some ways, in some examples, some of the same songs. So you saw songs like "We Shall Not Be Moved," which was a song that had been used, it was older than the civil rights movement, had been used as a protest song throughout its existence in the coal mines of West Virginia, for instance. And that was a song that was, if you will, repurposed and changed. Perhaps the most sung song in the civil rights movement was the song "This Little Light of Mine." One of my favorite examples of that is a version by a young song leader from Selma, Alabama, Betty Mae Fikes, who sings the song with such power and really reinvents it with in a way where she extends the kind of call to bring people into the song, and she leads them talking about where they lay out all the people who were fighting against them. So this was in Selma, where Jim Clark was the sheriff, who was a really powerful figure and a really frightening figure, and she says, "Tell Jim Clark I'm going to let it shine. Tell Governor Wallace, George Wallace, I'm going to let it shine." "We Shall Overcome" was the anthem of the civil rights movement, or the signal song of the civil rights movement, and sung quite often. But then again, popular songs. The program that we did last year called "Sing for Freedom," we used a song called "Fighting for My Rights," which was a song that was taken from a Ray Charles song called "Lonely Avenue," which was a popular song at the time, and that song, "Lonely Avenue," was then changed into "Fighting for My Rights," and a song. Again, this is something that really the young people, the students, brought into the movement using some of the popular songs that they listened to on the radio and danced to at parties. Another Ray Charles song, and Ray Charles was particularly looked on with favor by the students in the movement because he refused to play segregated facilities. He refused to stay in segregated hotels when he traveled around the South, and he was, of course, one of the biggest stars at the time. And his famous song, "Hit the Road, Jack," was changed by the students to "Get Your Rights, Jack."
So how do you go about using these types of songs when you develop programs here at the museum?
Well, of course, here at the Smithsonian, we do have the kind of the access to and the legacy of Bernice Johnson Regan, who her collection is here in the archives and so forth. But Everyone through Smithsonian Folkways has access to some of her research, an anthology called Voices of the Civil Rights Movement that she produced, which is an anthology of music from 1960 to 1966, available from Smithsonian Folkways. That is a great resource for the music, and these are actual recordings from the time period, great explanations of both musically and historically how these songs were used.
What do you think that the study of song and the study of music can teach people, and students specifically, about American history?
The music can really, looking at this music particularly, and I think, you know, you can transfer this to other types of music as well, but I think it really gives you a glimpse of the soul of that time. We've talked a bit about civil rights music, and that is certainly the case there. When you listen to we mentioned the song leader Betty Mae Fikes in Selma, another song that I can recall of that she led was a song, If You Miss Me from the Back of the Bus. And the song talks about, if you miss me from the back of the bus and you can't find me, come to the front of the bus and I'll be sitting up there. But song leaders would change these lyrics all the time. In this case, she might say, if you miss a teacher, if you miss Mr. Johnson, you know, you can't find him nowhere, come over to the school and you'll find him teaching there. But she, in Selma, took it even farther, where she was then laying out people like, Sheriff Jim Clark, where she was talking about the governor, George Wallace, and she says, if you miss George Wallace and you can't find him, come over to the crazy house and you'll find him over there. Come over to the funeral home or the graveyard and you'll find Jim Clark there, sort of. And that was something that it was rather uncommon in the civil rights movement to lay out your sort of enemies or your oppressors like that, and suggest perhaps that you wish them to be taken away somewhere. It speaks to how, and Betty Mae Fikes, when she was singing that, if you listen to the Smithsonian Folkways collection of this, she was 15 years old, and so it speaks to what this 15-year-old girl was thinking. But I think when you look at even more popular music, you know, of the 19th century, music about baseball and so forth, you can really get glimpse of what was important to people and what type of humor those people had, not just the things that are important to them, but just what they thought was funny, what they thought, what they spent their time doing, how they communicated with one another. I think the study of music in that way is really an essential part of understanding a different time period.
I'd like to thank Chris Wilson for taking the time to speak with us. For the History Explorer podcast series, this is Matt Ringelstetter. Join us again next month as we take another look behind the scenes here at the National Museum of American History. Funding for this podcast provided by the Verizon Foundation.
Yeah.
Jazz has become one of our country's most venerated and celebrated traditions. The Smithsonian's National Museum of American History has played an integral part in telling the story of jazz. And behind that story is much more than just the music.
Actually, in the 70s, it was recognized that there were these artists out there that their lives were being documented on recorded history as performers, but not in spoken word. And the recorded history of their playing is very important, but it only tells a sliver of their really who they are and how they got to that point.
That was Ken Kimry, who, in addition to being the current executive director of the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra, is the lead on the Jazz Oral History Project, which is tasked with documenting firsthand accounts of people important to the development of jazz. This project has a great sense of urgency, as many of these artists had their start in the Jazz Age, which is a term popularized by F. Scott Fitzgerald to mean the period between the end of World War I and the beginning of the Great Depression.
These individuals who might have been interviewed back then were still with us, but they're senior in age, and those that had not been documented were also senior in age, and those important stories were being lost. Or they're being told through a secondary source that really didn't give the true inflections and essence of what that person's life was all about and their impact.
The project started as a joint venture between the Smithsonian, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Rutgers Institute of Jazz Studies in the early 70s, and it eventually captured the life stories of 120 artists, such as Count Basie, Mary Lou Williams, and Charles Mingus, in interviews ranging from 5 to 35 hours. But as many arts-related programs in the early 1980s, the program was forced to close due to lack of funding. Virtually none of the artists that were interviewed then are alive today. The program stayed dormant until 1992, when Lila Wallace, co-founder of the Reader's Digest, was looking to fund a substantial and meaningful project at the museum. The Jazz Oral History Project was just that.
One gentleman that I always think about is John Levy. John was born in 1912 in New Orleans. And sitting in the interview, he basically spelled out 20th century American history right in front of me. And you realize that, okay, it so happens that jazz is thread through there, but this is just a powerful story to tell that has reach in a broader sense than one would think that just on stage performing. So it was recognized early on that the oral histories really provide an important testimonial to life in this country, world culture, cultural diplomacy, great migration. I mean, really dynamic stories that were being told by these singular informants. What it has done is help inform us also about the development of the music, because of the fact that artists typically express themselves through their own personal experiences.
Let's listen to a clip from that interview. This is John Levy, a celebrated bassist who went on to manage some of the most famous names in jazz.
I recall them wanting me to take lessons on the piano, have a piano. No. So my mother went down and tried to buy a piano to Wurlitzer, downtown on Wabash Avenue in Chicago, to try to buy a piano. Well, they'd sell it a piano, but they wouldn't sell it to a woman. I just had to have my father, had to have a husband or a man to sign for it. Otherwise, they wouldn't sell it to her. So my uncle went down and acted as my father, because my father couldn't barely sign his name, and you would never have been able to get him to go down there and embarrass himself in any kind of way that way. So he didn't do it, but my uncle did, and we got a piano. The style of piano we got was piano rolls, the way they had the rolls mm-hmm. and the piano, and you could play the rolls and pump it, and you could see the notes going up and down on the keyboard. And that's what we had. That's the piano we bought in the house.
And that gave you the first lessons in,
yeah.
in how to play?
And I didn't really take any lessons with it. I just sat down there and started playing by ear and learning songs.
Ken, what is it about doing an oral history that pulls stories like that?
First thing, we've done a tremendous amount of research up front to make sure that we understand, have a knowledge of who they are, and try not to go down the same path that has been gone down to many times with or interviews in these individuals in the past, where they've been more of really a sliver or slice of their life. So what we're doing, what we do is we open up the door in a way that hasn't been done. And that's the methodology of oral history, is that you're looking at their entire life through their words. We're just helping facilitate them tell the stories. So our objective is to minimize our intrusion into it, help guide them down these paths, hopefully have them open up a door they haven't opened up in a long time, and walk through that and explore their life that they hadn't thought about in many years. And that's really the difference between, and the benefit of doing an oral history, is that you get these informants to open up and talk about their life that they hadn't thought about, because nobody really had taken the opportunity or the time to do that.
Ken, I'm sure some of our listeners would be interested in starting their own oral history projects this summer. What would you tell someone who's interested in doing oral histories?
Well, I think probably the most immediate is family oral histories. I think that's because of, here we're in the holiday season coming up, and families typically come together, and you have multi-generation families. And so having the grandson or granddaughter sit down with the grandparent or grandmother and start that process, just have them talk about their childhood. Have them really dig into their life in those earlier days. So it's that's probably the most immediate and the easiest way, because if you already have a personal connection, you know the subject, there's a lot of great comfort there because of that relationship. And probably to help in preparing is, of course, talking to your parents, because your parents are going to help inform you with those stories about your grandparents that you can use as a vehicle to open up those doors or at least start the conversation. I think that's probably, I would say, the easiest way, and I think a very important thing to do, because the family history typically gets lost. It's not documented in a way that it could be. When you take it to the next level, if you're looking about those within your area of interest that have inspired you, then I always believe in just, if you approach them, contact them, you tell them what your intent is, you show the sense of sincerity and the commitment and the insight into their career and their life, that typically opens the door for the opportunity to do that. Even in cold calling, because of the fact that you recognize there's an investment and interest in this person's life.
Thank you, Ken. You can listen to more clips of Jazz Oral Histories at smithsonianjazz.org or by setting up an appointment with the National Museum of American History's archives. Additionally, be sure to check out the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra if you're in the D.C. area. Their final concert of the season is June 16th, paying tribute to jazz vocalist Joe Williams, whose longtime manager was none other than John Levy. Thanks for listening.
Today on the History Explorer podcast, we'll be hearing from Ken Kimmery, producer of the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra and himself an established percussionist. Ken's going to discuss the life of jazz artist Mary Lou Williams. Ken stresses the importance of learning about the lives and stories of jazz musicians like Mary Lou Williams, in addition to her musical performances, as a unique way of gaining an insight into American history.
My name is Ken Kimmery. I'm the executive producer of the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra, residence in resident orchestra at the National Museum of American History. What I'm going to talk about here is a pianist and also band leader by the name of Mary Lou Williams. She was born in May 8, 1910 in Atlanta, Georgia, and early on defined herself as being somebody of great talent on the piano at a young age of 3 and 4 by being able to listen to piano rolls of Jelly Roll Morton and James B. Johnson and pretty much replicate that style of playing. This developed a real strong sense of the history of the music and learning boogie-woogie and that style of music during that period of time. This was recognized pretty early on, too, and also with band leaders. So at the age of 14, she actually was a performing professional musician on the road with a vaudeville act. As her career progressed, there was a particular band that she became known as a not just a pianist but a composer, and actually started her career in a direction that we now have recognized as being very important contribution to the history of jazz. The band that she started her start with was a band by the name of Annie Kirk and the Clouds of Joy. At first, she came in more as a, as they say, an ersatz pianist or the second pianist, and also some arrangements. And by 1930, through fate, she then was brought on as the primary pianist, and identified and recognized early on too that her piano skill and compositional skills were something that elevated the band as just being a territory band or a dance band to something that really had great popularity. One typically associates a woman as not being a very physical player, but this was not the case, and she proved that was not the case because of her playing was very assertive, very strong, very, very masterful, and it turned a lot of heads in a way that put her in a position of actually being a teacher to some of the great pianists that followed. That being in the bebop era, you have Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell. So she influenced a lot of players based upon her incredible talent as a pianist. She had then left Annie Kirk's band, and to her benefit too, she was being noticed for her arranging, writing and arranging skills, which led her to a short period of time as a staff arranger for Duke Ellington. And one selection that was that stood above all of them that she had arranged was called Blue Skies, and Blue Skies can be heard many different versions. There are performances of it, but Mary Lou really set the standard. In going back, just one more point to Andy Kirk, the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra. In its centennial celebration, did a sampling of her career, musical career, by looking back to her early days with Andy Kirk on all the way forward, as far forward. And one of the samplings of that period of time is a selection called Walking and Swinging, which is a wonderful piece that you can tell it's a dance piece, but also showcases that point in the composition arrangement where the piano stands out, and it shows that mastery of her ability. Also, found herself not just as an arranger, but as a solo artist. And the opportunity came in 1943 when Caffe Society in Greenwich Village ended up featuring her as a headliner. And this provided her an opportunity to actually then write music for this ensemble. She chose in a setting that allowed her to further explore music beyond just the parameter of being a arranger composer for a dance band. So the exploration, which one can hear in the development of her playing, really probably came about because of this transition, you know, the Caffe Society, where she had that opportunity to push the envelope. This can be heard, I would say, probably in starting in 1948, maybe a little earlier than that, but there was a piano trio recording called the Zodiac Suite, and very, very harmonically progressive. She really, really started pushing the envelope, and it turned a lot of heads again, because here's somebody who came out of the swing era, primarily popular dance, was able to make the transition, and there are a lot of musicians that had difficulty making that transition. So she really, throughout her whole career, was always developing, always searching, not content with the idea of just enjoying the success and the fame of those earlier days, but really, as a true artist, reaching to new heights and new depths to figure out where this path might lead.
It sounds like Mary Lou Williams was not only involved with and influenced some of the bigger names in American jazz history, but she was also really involved in the different eras of it as well. Is it common for a woman to have been influencing people like Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell, or been involved in jazz history as much as she was?
No, typically, if you go back and look at the history of women within the music, and the music itself is primarily a male-dominated, so you would find women primarily being in the role of a vocalist or a pianist, and outside of that, really not having an opportunity or rarely have an opportunity to be able to find themselves in other areas of the orchestra. And then, on top of that, how they would influence the period of time, be recognized for their artistic excellence. And there's very few that have had that opportunity. One can say Ella Fitzgerald fits within that mold because of the fact that she, after being discovered at the Apollo Theater, and then joining the Chick Webb Band, who was a hunchback drummer, him passing away, she was the one who was anointed to take over the band. And that said a lot about the recognition of her artistic strength, what she brought to this band, and the respect. And Mary Lou is the same thing. She was one of those few that was recognized because of the fact she could hold her own. She was one that actually not only played the instrument, but defined the period of time with their ability, and then also pushed it forward. If you look at parallel Ella and Mary Lou, they both were rooted in a swing era period of time, but they continued to move forward in a way that advanced the music, and they were an integral part of that body, that select few that had that ability and vision and intestinal fortitude to do exactly that.
Now, sometimes in maybe high school or middle school history classes, the topic of jazz in American society and American culture comes up, but a lot of times it's just brought up in the context of some other topic. And of course, it's covered in music classes. But why do you think jazz history is important when learning the history of the United States of America?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and this is something that we struggle with, have been struggling with for a long time. When we think about jazz, we only think about the musicians on stage. We think of them as performing musicians. The reality is that these individuals have been instrumental within the historical moments in time that define who we are and help define who we are. Case in point, a gentleman by the name of John Levy, who was born 1912 in New Orleans, Great Migration, ended up Chicago, bass player, continued to learn his craft at the same time he was running numbers for the mob. So that talks about a little bit American history there, talking about New Orleans to Chicago. Those things are studied about 20th century American history. Well, here's somebody who is a jazz musician that is a reflection of that and so much part of that. His life then took him to New York, 52nd Street, playing with a violinist by the name of Stuff Smith. John transitioned to a British blind pianist by the name of George Shearing. Now, we say John Levy. Levy's a Jewish name. John is an African-American man. So we can go back and say, okay, wait a minute. You got a Jewish name. He's African-American. What's that all about? So there's a bit of American history. If you just look at that, you say there's American history there that we got to, you know, we're talking about plantation, we're talking about slavery, we're talking about a whole bunch of things that are folded in there that by this one individual following his life story, start to realize, wait a minute, we can take something instead of talking about just dates, but personalize it by one individual and showing his life's history, which becomes something that I find to be more interesting because of now being able to identify with this individual. We're looking at a person, not just a historic event, but this individual who is threaded through this and actually is an integral part of it. These unique stories really are 20th century American history.
That was Ken Kimmery discussing Mary Lou Williams and jazz history. To learn more, go to smithsonianjazz.org. Join us again next time as we take another look into what goes on behind the scenes here at the National Museum of American History. This podcast has been made possible by a grant from the Verizon Thinkfinity Foundation. Music provided by the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra.
Thanks for listening to the first Road Trip edition of the History Explorer podcast. Turn back on the music and enjoy the rest of your trip.